ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 is go, the first human mission to the moon in more than 50 years. And we are following every step of the journey, from lunar flyby to splashdown, in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Join me, Belinda Smith, for mission updates so you know what's happening and why it matters. It's Artemis Explained. Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. Today, we're taking a break from Iran, and instead I want to introduce you to someone with a truly incredible life story, one that's inspired her to become the host of a new ABC podcast. Sesonke Msimang grew up in exile, kept from South Africa, the country she considered home because her father was a freedom fighter against apartheid. She spent her childhood on the run, moving between countries, watching a liberation movement grow in power and eventually succeed from the inside. The podcast she's hosting is called Boycott, and it's all about how apartheid was defeated in South Africa over decades of freedom fighting, resistance and protest. It's a fascinating podcast. You can hear it now on the ABC Listen app. But her own personal story is fascinating too, and she's going to share that with us today. Sesonke, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here.
First off, tell me about the Boycott podcast. It's quite far-reaching. You go all the way from Nelson Mandela, obviously, but less obviously, you're talking about Joe Bjelke-Petersen as well.
That's right, yes. The idea is we wanted to talk about the boycott movement. And of course, in order to talk about how people boycotted apartheid, we had to talk about the different ways that people did that. So we start by describing what apartheid is and what an egregious system it was and how morally outraged people were around the world, including in Australia. And then we talk about sports because there was a huge element of the boycott movement that was about sports. And in particular in Australia, that took the form of massive boycotts against the Springbok Tour when they came in the 1970s. Mm. And then we talk about the boycott movement around goods and products. So not buying South African was a huge theme. People, you know, had protest placards saying, don't buy South African. And then we talk about what came towards the end, which was the real massive cultural push. No artists playing in South Africa, no collaborations with performers. So we kind of run the gamut of what boycott in its fullest meaning of the word really means. Yeah.
It sounds fantastic. I'm really excited to hear the rest of the episodes. But I want to ask you specifically about your story. Your dad, Mavuso, was involved in the South African freedom fighter movement himself, and he's a big part of this story. Tell me about the South Africa that he grew up in.
So my dad was born in 1941. Apartheid starts in 1948. So he's born before apartheid begins in a small community called Edendale, which is quite a fascinating community in itself because it's run by these Africans who are landowners, which is rare. But they're landowners because they're Christians. Yeah. And so they're very dignified, very proud people. So my dad is born into that stock. So there's a strong sense of sort of self-pride and communalism in his little upbringing. And then when he's seven, apartheid comes into being. And very quickly thereafter, life begins to change. So before apartheid, there's colonization, right? So the British are in charge.
Yeah.
They're the
yeah.
colonizers. But it's a kind of power-sharing agreement where the white minority, which is made of British descendants and Dutch descendants, the British are kind of in charge. And the Dutch descendants in 1941 say, enough is enough. We're a minority within a white minority, and we're taking over. And they institute this super egregious form of racism. Like, I guess all forms of racism are egregious, but this is like, especially because it begins to categorize people. Not only are people categorized, it begins to move people around. Black people can only live here. White people must live there. You know, so it's like, you know, super intense. And so my dad's generation are the last generation of people who, when they finish high school in, you know, in the early 1960s, they actually sit the same exam as the white students. So his education, his base level education is just excellent. And he goes to this famous, you know, wonderful university called Fort Hare University, which I like to describe as like the Harvard of Southern Africa. Mm. You know, so every major political figure across most of independence Africa actually attends Fort Hare. And Nelson Mandela mm-hmm. also goes to Fort Hare. So he's one of the alum. So obviously he's a lot older than my dad. My dad thinks about Nelson Mandela as this, you know, as a hero, and his influence is palpable. It can be felt everywhere.
So your dad joined the African National Congress, which started as a nonviolent protest movement, but in the early 1960s started to change. Is that right?
That's right. So the Defiance campaign happens. It's very successful. They're boycotting, right? So they're an early blueprint of what it looks like to withhold your services from people in order to disable them economically. So they're doing bus boycotts and saying black people will not take the bus. They'd rather walk to work. All of that sort of stuff that you've seen if you've watched any movie about the civil rights movement in the US, the same thing is happening in South Africa at the time. And then in 1960, a peaceful protest is called by a group called the Pan-African Congress. It's a breakaway from the ANC, same principles, same vibe, same Gandhian tactics. So they go march to the police station. At the time, black people are all forced to carry what they call a dompas. A dompas is an ID, a form of identification only for Africans. You give black people a pass to allow them to work for 6 months in a particular area, and then they have to go back to the rural area. So they can't organize, so they can never have permanent location in one place, right? Anyway, so there's a dompas system. These people are protesting it in this small community outside of Johannesburg called Sharpeville, and the police open fire.
The apartheid system showed how far it was prepared to go in defense of its existence when police opened fire on several thousand demonstrating blacks in the township of Sharpeville. 69 Africans were killed and 180 wounded.
The world kind of recoils. And the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress, which had until then been employing nonviolence, say, this is getting us nowhere and it's time to go underground and take up arms.
So your dad joined a group of people leaving the country to organize themselves. Where did they go and why?
So they leave the country, and my dad very quickly finds himself shuttled off to an East African country called Tanzania. And from Tanzania, they get on an Aeroflot plane, and they go to Russia.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would feel quite different. I mean, that would be quite a change for someone who's grown up in South Africa.
It's a huge change. Absolutely huge change. And they have the great coats, and they give them the, you know, the fluffy hats and the whole thing. He's with a group of about 20 other young people who are all forces of the African National Congress, the first cohort who are going to be trained in guerrilla warfare. Their trainers are these World War II veterans from, you know, the Russian army. And so they're taught topography and reconnaissance and Morse code and like all of this stuff. Because, of course, this is the Cold War. So it's the 1960s. And there's two sides of the world that you belong to. You're either with the Soviets, USSR, or you're on the American side. And depending on who's backing you, that's where you get all your resources. That's where you get, you know, your people are educated, et cetera, et cetera. So my dad spends 9 months learning all of this stuff. And they have a sense that they're going to be able to get back into the country. And the idea for the South African Revolution, because they, remember, they were forced into adopting violence. So they're not really about shooting people and killing people. It's not that type of revolution. What they really want to do is blow up pylons, is to disrupt the infrastructure. And their plan is that they're going to go all the way down to South Africa, fighting, crossing borders. It's an ill-conceived plan. It doesn't happen. They end up stuck. And he finally makes his way to Lusaka.
And Lusaka is, just to stop anybody from just having to get maps up, Lusaka is the capital of Zambia, which is two countries up from South Africa. If you want to go from South Africa to Zambia, you have to go through either Zimbabwe or Botswana.
Like cities everywhere, Lusaka is a magnet for people from the country. It's also a magnet for some groups of people whose lives are anything but ordinary and humdrum. Zambia's fierce opposition to the white minority regimes of Southern Africa has led it to give sanctuary to guerrilla organizations engaged in subversive intrigue against most of Zambia's neighbors.
And there's a bunch of other revolutionaries who are also in Lusaka at the time. So Lusaka is home to the Angolan Liberation Movement, MPLA. It's home to SWAPO, which is the Namibian Revolutionary Forces. It's home to ZANU and ZAPU, which are the Zimbabwean Liberation Forces. So all of these groups, at least five different sort of revolutionary groups, all have bases in Zambia because its president, Kenneth Kaunda, is this, you know, leader who went to Fort Hare with Nelson Mandela.
Oh, of course. Right.
Right. So he's had a very similar trajectory in the 1950s to becoming the president of the country. The British locked him up after he had peaceful demonstrations and protests, fighting for the freedom of his people. So he kind of gets it, right? And so when the ANC goes into exile, goes underground after the Sharpeville massacre, it has to have a headquarters. It's banned inside South Africa. And so it only exists outside South Africa and it needs office space. It literally just needs like an operating base. The Russians provide it military support and then the Zambians provide the ANC with administrative support. And they provide the same thing to all those other liberation movements. So it's like a pretty radical kind of, you know, one battle after another sort of scene.
It's kind of like the embassy district of a capital city, except everybody there is an exiled liberation fighter.
That's exactly right. And of course, in the 1970s, in 75, the Cubans come.
Of course they do, yeah.
Of course they do, because they get involved in the war in Angola because it's a proxy war between America and Cuba. So there's all these revolutionaries. There's also, of course, the American Black Panthers. And so one of my dad's best friends is a guy called Curtis Powell, Dr. Curtis Powell, whose own life story is just remarkable. So he was part of the Panther 21, a group of Black Panthers who were rounded up in New York City and spent almost 2 years in Rikers Island before all charges against them were dropped. But in Lusaka, he's just part of the vibe, mm-hmm. part of this really interesting new generation of Black activists who are radical but also quite educated and who are very much about reshaping the world, part of the non-aligned movement, you know. So there's just all of this stuff happening. So every weekend at our house was like ANC people and there's Black Panthers. And of course, there's a huge amount of Russians and a lot of Russian aunties because all of these ANC people who were educated like my dad was in Russia came back with, you know, wives. And so they were all part of this environment. So my auntie Rita was married to Uncle Sindiso and they had kids and we would all go off to the Young Pioneers, which was a Soviet children's movement, young people's movement aimed at, you know, learning Marx, as you
this
do.
This is the most insane thing that I've heard of. This little area of the capital of Zambia that had a mixture of, in the 1970s, of all these radical African liberation groups, plus Russians and Cubans and Black Panthers. I don't know why there aren't movies set in this location. That sounds fantastic. This is where you were born. This is where you grew up.
Yes, this is where I was born, and I lived there until the early 1980s. And so, yeah, this was absolutely my first taste of what life was just growing up in this community of super radical, wonderful people.
What was that like? What was going to school like in this community?
I mean, there was school, which was fine. It was just whatever you learn, regularly learn in school. And then there was weekends, which were like school. Mm. So as I said, we had the Young Pioneers. And so
you had Soviet spy training to go to, of course, you know.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly. And there were lots of kids in our community who were often shipped off to go to places. So there was a Black Sea summer camp for kids, which even as I say it sounds ridiculous.
Okay, or whatever, okay.
It sounds ridiculous as I say it, but it's true. And I remember being so jealous that the bigger kids got to go and I didn't.
Oh, man, I didn't get to go to Yalta.
And there was a similar one in Cuba, Havana. Oh. And I remember that one of the kids who went to that camp, and it was long. I mean, we were little kids, right? And so people would send their, like, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old off to Cuba for like 3 months. And then the kids would be like sad and homesick and lonely. But you had to sort of have the stiff upper lip because you're a revolutionary kid, right? And so you couldn't really complain about being homesick when you're being sent for the revolution.
Nothing in this conversation has hit home so much to me about the difference between your upbringing and mine than the idea that while people in your community were going to Cuba and the Black Sea for camp, we would go to Canberra.
Little different.
I mean, it seems radically, you know, fundamentally different sort of environment. I mean, obviously it was different, but nothing's made it clearer than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that there's a place like this anywhere else in the world today where there's a bunch of revolutionaries all meeting together?
No, I don't think there is, actually. I think it was a moment in time, and a lot of things kind of made it possible, including a remarkable amount of idealism amongst a whole generation of people. And the violence of the apartheid state and the fact that it had kind of no impunity and so would often have over raids flying over Lusaka just to scare the government, you know, just to say, we know that you're harboring these people and at any moment we can do, you know, what we want. And also, I think the Cold War made it possible for Africans to trade off against these superpowers. Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, that the Cold War is over and America won and capitalism won, right? And I think in many ways we're, you know, seeing the... Sorry to sound like an absolute socialist apparatchik, which is what I was raised to be, but yeah.
Yes, yeah. America won and it's going fine.
And it's still going all really well. Late stage capitalism is really working for me. I hope it's working for you too, yeah, Matt. Yeah.
Now, Sizonke, there's obviously a lot more to your story, at least I can tell that there is, from the fact that you're speaking in not a Russian, Cuban, or even Zambian accent. You're speaking in what I think is a Canadian accent, so there's a lot more to the story.
Canadian accent, but living in Australia, so yes, there is much, much more.
Before we go, because I don't want to tell the whole story that is in the podcast, but you're living in Perth now?
Yes, I live in WA.
How does Perth compare?
To Lusaka?
To Lusaka. You must feel right at home there in Perth.
So they're both very small cities with quite a few roundabouts. They've got those in common.
Yep. Nothing else.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing else. But I love WA and I love our beaches and I love lots of things about living in this
place. WA is great. But there's no Cuban and Russian spy school available.
No, there's no gumboot dancing on weekends and there's certainly no songs by the president that are unifying the entire nation. Yeah. So
maybe one day. You know, there has been occasionally calls for revolution coming out of Perth. So
listen, we have a very strong movement here. If anyone tries to mess with our GST.
Yeah, that's right. We'll take that as a warning. Thank you very much, Sizonke. Hey, thank you so much for speaking to us. What a fantastic story. And I'm really looking forward to hearing the rest of Boycott.
Thanks so much, Matt.
That's Sizonke there. You can catch more of the story on the ABC Rewind podcast, Boycott. There are already a few episodes out and a few more yet to come. On Thursday, we're taking a short break from the Iran war to look at a fascinating situation brewing in East Asia. China is a strong supporter of the governments in Myanmar and Cambodia. But in recent years, large numbers of Chinese people have been kidnapped by criminals in those countries and forced into slave labour, running text and phone scams. China has now decided that they don't really like this and want it to stop. But do they have enough influence to make that happen? That's coming up on Thursday on If You're Listening.